From pesos to pounds, euros to yen, Wise can help you manage your money in different currencies. With Wise, you can send money to your cousin in Australia in seconds. Travel internationally without having to brave an airport currency exchange desk or take the guesswork out of converting currencies. Wise lets you send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate, all without any hidden fees. Join 60 million customers already using Wise worldwide. To learn more about how a Wise account can work for you, download the app or visit Wise.com. That's Wise, W-I-S-E.com. Wise.com.
Support for this show comes from Art Beats and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within Art Beats and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art Beats and Lyrics now on Hulu.
Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Hello, welcome to the Longform Podcast. I'm Max Linsky. I'm here with my co-hosts, Aaron Lammer, Evan Ratliff. Gentlemen, hello.
Hey, Max.
Hey, Max. What have you got for us this week?
What I've got for you this week is Reginald Dwayne Betts. This might be the longest bio we've ever had, you guys.
Okay. I'm gonna recline in my chair here. Okay, go ahead.
Sit back while I tell you about all the things that Dwayne does. He is a poet. He has a one-man show. He's written a memoir. He's written several articles, including one for the New York Times Magazine in 2018 that won a National Magazine Award. He's a lawyer, and he is the founder and director of an organization called Freedom Reads, which puts libraries in prisons. He's also a podcast host. He's got a show out this summer. It's called Almost There. He's interviewing members of the Emerson Collective. And much of Dwayne's work centers around his experience as a 16-year-old of being sent to prison for 8 years, which is where he learned to write. So we talked about time management a little bit and also how you teach yourself to write as a young person in jail with adults.
I have unreclined now. I look forward to this interview. We are brought to you in partnership with Vox Media, who help us make this show. Thanks to everyone over at Vox.
And now here's Max with Reginald Dwayne Betts.
Hey, Dwayne. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
Yeah, nah, man. It's my pleasure. It's my pleasure to be here.
There are many, many things to talk to you about. I feel like this is one of these interviews where I don't know how we're going to fit it into an hour, but we'll try. But for people who are not familiar with your story, I was wondering if you could tell me, and it's a hard story to tell quickly, but if you can tell me what happened to you when you were 16 and how that informs why we're talking today.
Yeah, it is a hard story, I guess. Maybe it's an easy story to nail down into one sentence. But it's like Erasmus. It's how can you make that sentence longer and longer and longer and more interesting? And maybe by the time you get to the last iteration of it, it completely obscures the thing that you began with. And I think that's what my life story is trying to do that. But the thing I began with is when I was 16, I carjacked somebody. And, you know, I ended up getting arrested the next day and I pled guilty and was sentenced to serve 9 years in prison. And very early on, actually, maybe right after I got sentenced to prison, I decided to be a writer and that I was going to have to, you know, if I was going to have to serve 9 years in prison, the one thing that I could, the skill that I could nurture while I was inside was being a writer. So I committed to being a writer and then ultimately to being a poet. And that's kind of what led me to here, which is, you know, now I'm a lawyer and I run an organization called Freedom Reads. And I host a podcast called Almost There. And when I get time, I try to write a sentence or two.
And you're working on a one-man show?
Yeah, and I got a one-man show. It's actually, it's still in development, but I know it, though. I know it in my heart. I've done it. I've stood on stage for 90 minutes, which is actually amazing. It's a real different experience of art when you communicate with an audience in that kind of way. It's real intimate.
Intermittent sounds a little terrifying to me. I've got questions for you about all these various creative pursuits of yours and how they talk to each other. I've also just got like some like time management questions. I don't really understand how you do all of this stuff.
You and me both.
I find it both inspiring and a little terrifying. But I want to go back to, you know, that moment that you just moved through pretty quickly, which was deciding to be a writer. Why was that where you went? And then what does it look like to become a writer when you're incarcerated?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first thing is just I felt like I had to own becoming something. And intuitively, I understood that if I didn't lay claim to desiring to be something, that there would be too many other forces that would be pulling on me to dictate that I become something else. And in fact, it became a kind of organizing principle in my life. And it gave me an answer to the second question. You know, what do you do from a day-to-day basis? It's like, well, when you say you're a writer, if you know nothing else, then you know that you read. And then, you know, you pay attention to the world. You pay attention to what's around you. And you look for opportunities to be a writer, whether that's writing letters for the men around you, whether that's teaching people how to read, whether that's always just looking for the opportunity to think about what it means to be a writer. And then ultimately, it became, you know, I get this book slid under my cell doors. And so I was in a hole. And in the hole, books were contraband. And so the guys back there, you know, to sort of fight the loneliness, right? They set up a library. And then the only rule was if you ask somebody for a book, they would send you one. And so I'm in a hole, I'm a teenager, and I'm like, if somebody send me a book, hey, yo, send me a book. And they don't even know they don't know my name. It's just like Young Blood with Sale. And they slide me Dudley Randall's The Black Poets. And that's when I become a poet. And from that point on, you know, prison became the metaphor by which I understood the world. And poetry became the medium by which I understood like what it meant to write about the world and what it meant to take seriously the duty or responsibility to write about the world that I knew.
I read this quote of yours before we talked. It said, I went to prison when I was 16 and I spent the rest of my life since then trying to find more and more creative ways to leave it.
Yeah.
Were those poems that you were writing, those first poems, were they a way of leaving or were they a way of being there?
I think they were a way of feeling worthy of not being there. You know, the idea of prison has always been understood as a loss, and it was understood as a suffering. And it was understood as something that you deserved to go through. And the interesting thing about prison, about redemption, about mercy, about forgiveness is like you experienced the whole stretch of incarceration, but it's no clear way for you to identify the point where it was no longer needed. And you had these moments when what you think is true, it was no longer needed after this day or that day or that day. But what the fact of the matter is that you're still being in prison affirms that you're not worthy of redemption, of a second chance, of even safety. And so sometimes the writing of a poem becomes a way to assert that I'm worthy of safety, that I'm worthy of regard, that I'm worthy of care. And you know, and it's interesting because the poem doesn't get published and it doesn't, you know, create a passageway in the world for me in that moment. But what was true then and what I know is true now, you know, in retrospect, is that all of those poems were building a kind of bridge that would give me the passageway to, you know, escape prison.
That quote, you know, I spent the rest of my life trying to find more and more creative ways to leave it. It really stuck out to me because your work in a lot of ways, your written work is so much about trying to process and understand that time.
Yeah, but it's also an admission. I mean, the thing about that line is, it's an admission that you know, you don't leave prison. Or at least I didn't. I think some people do, but I didn't.
What do you mean by that?
You know, I think that you just have some experiences that just don't let you go. And in them, this is a fucked up analogy, right? But you know, the dude that played quarterback for his high school team and they won the championship, and he never was able to move beyond that. And it's tragic. And you feel like it's okay if the dude was an asshole, but it becomes really tragic if he was like a good guy who just was never able to imagine his life being more than that moment, you know? And the thing is, like, people understand that part of it because people get the feeling of being at the height of everything too early to even know what the height of it is. And so going to prison as a child is like you get to the bottom of everything before you even old enough to appreciate what it means on the bottom. You know, what it means to be on the bottom, what it means to really have suffered and have made people suffer. You know, I went to prison before I really knew any of those things. And yet the experiences of prison still operate as a kind of gravity on my life. And so most of life is a constant sort of walking away from it. But the difficulty, and I think the difficulty that comes up in the things I've read about is it's so much a society that doesn't let you let it go. And so that's one of the practical reasons why I'm always thinking of creative ways to leave it. But it's people that I left there as well. And I'm thinking about, seriously, what does it mean to be a thinker in a world who has written publicly about prison and has friends who are locked up, you know, for violent crimes, who've been locked up for decades, who've been locked up for crimes they claim they didn't commit. Like, what does all of that stuff mean? So I think that's what I mean when I say it won't let me go.
That idea of the impact of where you are when you're 16, 17, 18 years old and the hold that has on you, I hadn't quite thought about it that way before. Your Al Bundy analogy worked.
Yeah, man, you know. And it is interesting because, you know, now my, I hadn't thought about this show in that way, but in the way that whole show is like, what does it mean to confront, you know, your childhood and the lives of your children?
Yeah, I mean, there's an exception to the way you described it because I think Al Bundy's an asshole.
I think he is too, but I think the show. I mean, you know, you got to be of a certain generation to appreciate the craftsmanship of the writing in Al Bundy. You know, trying to get because he was a particular kind of asshole. But you know, but how do you have empathy for somebody who is like fundamentally ruined and kind of emasculated in ways that you disagree with because you feel like it's inappropriate? Like, there's nothing wrong with working in a women's shoe store. You know what I mean? like, so you kind of, you know, it is like most of us aren't good at sports. So it's like, cut the dude a break. Yeah, break.
He had some good years at Polk High. What are you going to do?
Yeah. Nobody talks about this.
Dwayne, this is exactly actually where I thought this interview was going to go. I was sure 10 minutes in we'd be talking about Married with Children. Can I ask you one more writing question from those early days?
Yeah.
The idea that it was a bridge, that it was a lifeline, that it was a, you know, just, it feels like the writing was so healthy, you know, it was so vital.
I had a lot of bad ideas.
That's what I was going to ask, was like, was it hard?
Yeah, I mean, it's like,
writing's hard.
That's what I mean. It's like, it's interesting because you're trying on ideas also, you know. And sometimes you're writing down a person's whole poem and you're trying the whole style on. You want to see what it felt like to just write like them. And you're saying their work out loud. And you're doing it for some practical reasons. You got the poem out of a book and the book has to go back to the library. So that's a practical reason. But you learn some craft reasons around it, what it means to, like, try their words on. And you know, as you do it, you then end up putting their words in your own words. And that's where the struggle comes in it. Because that's when you realize that sometimes your thinking is inadequate for the problems. And so, you know, I go back and look at it and it feels vital to me becoming the kind of poet I am. But sometimes I read it and I laugh, you know. It's like, I was like, yeah, you loved her. You know what I mean? It could be anything too. You know, it's like sometimes it's like my critique on society. And I was like, okay. You know what I mean? Or like about prison, it's these ideas that now feel like just a bit off. It's fun looking at them, you know, honestly, because actually, you know, I was in a prison cell writing, And I put the date on it. You know, it's like, it'd be like August 1998. Like, I took it so seriously.
Yeah.
And I had put these holes in it because I had threaded them up into a stack that's like this, that's like its own book. And so I took it so seriously. But then I go through the poems, and a lot of them are radically mediocre. Oh, man.
You're a 17-year-old kid writing poetry. You get to have some radically mediocre ones in there.
Yeah, man. It's like I was trying to be bad.
Who are you writing them for then? Did you have an audience in mind?
Myself, the guys. Sometimes I would read poems to the guys on the yard with me. I think it was almost like my cup of coffee. Mm-hmm. It was a part of my exercise routine. It was a part of my practice. And so in some ways, the poems and the writing of the poems was less about audience. I didn't fully understand audience, you know, even though I was sending out poems to get published in magazines. That was more for evaluation than audience.
Did you have any ambition beyond getting by?
No, because because nobody tells you, like, you're a world famous poet. Yeah, I mean, and even writing for the New York Times Magazine and the New Yorker and Harper's and some of these magazines that I had saw, you know, to be honest, and maybe in a purest sense of it, man, the only thing that mattered was the story. So I wasn't even at that point at that time where I was following the writers. And so it wasn't until I was in prison where I thought about the production of creative material as like labor that an individual was responsible for that then got acclaimed for or paid for or rewarded for. Even books that I read, I actually didn't even think about. And the only maybe contemporary writer I was reading as a kid was like Walter Mosley. But I read a lot of books, but I still didn't even think about that work as an artist as being the same as a teacher or a doctor or a lawyer or something like that. Like, it's funny. I just didn't think about them as being paid. So when I was going about the work of being a writer, it was purely to do the paces. It was purely to the production of a piece of work was like ritual. It was like prayer.
It was the exercise.
Yeah, so I got lucky. I got lucky because it was wildly pure. Not that purity matters all that much, but, you know.
Well, that's my question is does that purity matter? Like, do you think learning to write, making writing a part of your life with that kind of purity had an impact on your work?
I mean, it gives me a cool origin story. You know what I mean? But I don't want to be like, well, you folks, you know, you were always chasing celebrity. You grew up with black poets who have won Pulitzer Prizes. You know, it was like, I don't want to become that person. I do think it's something that was a value that, you know, it's so many poets that I know who I met, you know, in anthologies, who I met in books, but not in school, though, you know, not through other poets introducing me to their work. And I feel something about that. I feel like I got a interesting kind of relationship with words. But do I think it really means anything for the kind of writer I am? Probably not. I just think it meant that I developed in a place that was lonelier than other people. And that might be good, but it might be some bad to that as well, you know. But the thing is, like, the way I grew up, you know, I didn't have really the groups of friends who were reading, like, Morris and Cornel West. And so sometimes I missed that. Sometimes I was the only person reading the stuff that I was reading, or the only person I knew reading the stuff that I was reading. And I didn't have a lot of time to talk about the stuff that I was reading with people around me. And it's still huge gaps in my reading that I kind of regret. So, you know, I think I got some benefits from the whole writing in solitude, writing in loneliness. But that means I was educated in that same solitude and that same loneliness. And I regret. Some of my regrets is more about what that meant for me developing as an intellectual and the kind of conversations I didn't have with friends.
Do you think that's part of why you seem to be having so many conversations now?
That's a good question. You spend all this time inside. I mean, first, you know, you spend a lot of time inside and you can't talk about yourself if you're a kid, you know, because all the things you might say about yourself make you vulnerable. So I think you do less talking.
Didn't reading your poems to the guys make you a little vulnerable?
Nah, and I mean, I'm telling you, like, I wasn't reading, I wasn't coming out, like I read my poems with strangers more now than I did then. I mean, the poems really weren't that good. And also, I wasn't.
I just imagine, like, you, like, walking up to a group of.
Nah, because.
I've been working on this poem.
Yeah, nah, I was paying attention. It'll be more like, it'd be more like, you know, first of all, it took years before. I mean, it's like, I'm in this hole and there's a dude beside me. Let me check this joint out. But I don't even really know how to read now, man. I got to, you know, so back then, I didn't even know how to read it. I got a flow now. I'm not nervous. This is the wildest part of it, you know. And these folks had never heard somebody read a poem before. But then I remember reading a poem out loud for the first time. I was at a Black History concert. And I got my little paper in front of me. And I'm nervous. It was prison. It was prison. And I didn't read to people, so it didn't make me vulnerable. Actually, it was a life that, I mean, you know, my folks knew I was a writer, but that's because they saw me writing all the time, but not because I was reading to them. And then when I got something published, and I'm shouting, I'm like, yo, I got published. I'm going to be in a book, and I'm jumping on the table. And they like, yo, Shahid is bugging. He talking about he in a book. He's talking about that poetry shit, you know what I mean? And so people didn't really know what it was, but they knew how I responded to it.
Wise is the app that makes using different currencies easy. Need to send dollars to your cousin in Bali fast? Getting paid in another currency and don't want to lose out because of inflated exchange rates? Want travel money without having to slog through the currency exchange kiosk? Then Wise just might be your answer. From pesos to pounds, euros to yen, Wise takes the guesswork out of converting currencies. You can send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate with no markups and no hidden fees. In 2023, people sent over $100 billion worldwide with Wise. What's more, over half of those transfers got to their destination in less time than it takes to listen to this ad. Whether you're traveling, spending money abroad, or doing business, let Wise help you manage your money in different currencies with ease. Join 16 million customers already using Wise worldwide. To learn more about how a Wise account can work for you, download the app or visit Wise.com. That's Wise, WISE.com. Wise.com.
Fox Creative.
This is advertiser content from 26.2 Team Milk and their new docuseries, Running Sucks.
Is running the worst?
Yeah.
Do you love it? Do you hate it?
I hate it so much. I hate it so freaking much.
That you're a real runner now!
I hate it.
I'm Abby Ayers, a 37-year-old mom from Utah who found herself running across the Manhattan Bridge in my first race ever.
Running Sucks celebrates women who run and the running communities that carry them across the finish line.
Running helped me in so many ways postpartum.
It really is about taking my power back and proving myself wrong.
For every person like you, I'm telling you, you belong, and I'm telling you, you can do it.
I never thought the words would leave my mouth, but yes, I'm planning on running a marathon. I can't even say it without laughing, because, like, who would have thought?
Watch Running Sucks at runningsucktheseries.com and learn more about how Team Milk is helping women runners across the country conquer their next course.
You said before that you had a interesting relationship with words.
Yeah, I think the impulse is to think a person that talks a lot is really gregarious and outgoing. And I think there's some truth to that. But, you know, I found maybe that what going to prison did was teach me how, you know, you could also use words to, like, mask your loneliness. You could use words to mask your inability to sit with the silences, right? But also, and this is for me, you know, the difference between just being a talker and becoming a writer. Becoming a writer helped me temper the part of me that was just a talker, that was just trying to avoid having to think about the serious things that were troubling me. You know, as a writer, I could be more vulnerable than I ever could talking. And then being a writer part let me see that, let me see some of the excesses I had in my speech because of what I wanted to avoid, which was, you know, my own vulnerability. And as my voice as a writer has come close to my voice as somebody who's speaking, I think that you know, the writing and the speaking has benefited from the best that the other has to offer.
Does it feel like there's a gap between the two? Does it feel like there's a gap between who you are on the page and who you are in all of this kind of public life of yours?
No, I'm good. I mean, and I think actually this is like the thing that writers struggle with. I think, and Killer Mike has something to the effect that like since it's not a gimmick, I don't have to be on guard for what I say next or something. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's I'm okay. I think that that's one of the things that I'm happy about is that it's not a gimmick, so I'm not worried about how I got to present myself in different audiences and spaces. And to the degree that it is some difference between myself, it's because maybe the writer is more thoughtful and more forgiving, and maybe the person, the me that's just talking, is a little more braver and reckless than the writer. You know, mm-hmm. Like I'll ask for forgiveness, and sometimes as a writer, I'll just not write a piece instead of writing it wrong. And sometimes you got to write it wrong to write it right, you know. But I'll just not write a piece.
Maybe another way of asking that question. If, you know, none of it's a gimmick, you've written so incredibly personally about yourself, about your family, about your kids, about your mom. Is there anything that you keep for yourself?
I mean, that's two different questions, though, right? So I guess when I think about it being a gap between a writer and me, the writer, and me, the person that's talking when I'm in the world, so much of who I am that is not going to be able to develop in public. The vulnerabilities aren't going to be able to happen in public. Some of the questioning won't happen. And then some of the regular curiosities just won't happen in public. And so being a writer was one way to functionally acknowledge that that stuff was important and had to happen on the page. And it was a way to acknowledge that, you know, you think on the page as well. I will say maybe one of the challenges, though, is that that does mean that I learned how to be acceptable parts of who I am, how to be less vulnerable parts of who I am in public. And so it created that kind of distance between who the identities were. I do think it's closer than it might be in other circumstances, just because as a poet, you always trying to communicate with the audience. And I got caught up in a speaking, doing public speaking about the criminal justice system, which meant that I was actually trying to be, embody my full self on a stage at any given time. And I think all of that influenced the kind of artist and poet and writer that I've tried to be over the years, to bring those two bodies closer together. But the question of if it's something that I say for myself is a good one, and mainly that's the one that drives me to keep writing. I'm constantly discovering, you know, what it is that I've held close to vest, because again, I think a big part of writing is to try to figure things out, and so that's where the thinking and the trying to figure things out is happening.
Can I ask you about one more gap?
Yeah.
You wrote this piece for the New York Times Magazine in 2018. It's incredible. I remember reading it when it came out, and I'm interested in how you ended up writing that piece. But there's a line in it where you say that prison is the distance between the world and me, and you know that it had now become the distance between you and your son. And just hearing the way you were just talking about thinking about writing about your past and thinking about distance, I wonder, you know, 5 years later, how much is that still the case? And has writing closed that distance? Has it widened it? Where are you at with that now?
Yeah, I think it's interesting, actually, that line. One, because, you know, it's Coates, but it's Richard Wright. It's different generations of Black men. Me and Coates are the same generation, but of Black men thinking about race in America, but thinking about it in different ways. And I think that that's probably a question that I'll keep asking and keep answering. And I think it's interesting now because my son, both of them, but the oldest one definitely, who's 15, is old enough to begin to have some of his own ideas about this question. And you know, it's interesting. Before I wrote that piece, I don't think I would have said that. I mean, I would have thought it, and I probably would have said some version of it, but it was really the writing of the piece that got me to articulating that specific idea.
How'd you end up writing that piece?
I was trying to get another piece and they weren't interested.
What was the one they weren't interested in?
I wanted to write a piece about getting a tattoo. I got an Ansem Kiefer piece tattooed on my back. And nobody was interested in it. And it was such a good idea. I mean, it was like, you know, because I had did all this time in prison and I hadn't got a tattoo. And Kiefer has this piece called Language of Birds. And it's this giant stack of books with wings shooting out the spine of the books. And it's a sculpture and it's huge. And I got it tattooed on my back and it was the first tattoo I got. And you don't get a huge back piece as your first tattoo. But also I was in prison and my celly was the tattoo guy. And I made all these conscious choices about why I didn't want to get a tattoo. And so I thought it was ripe ground to investigate. Nobody else agreed with me, though, you know. But as I was talking to her about this piece, and she liked my writing, you know, and this is Elena Silverman. She said, do you have any other ideas? And I just happened to be passing the public defender's office, the courthouse where I worked. And I was like, well, you know, I mean, I do work every day with these young folks, and it's weird, you know, being a soon-to-be lawyer representing them, not knowing if I'll be able to, you know, represent them if I pass the bar exam because I got to pass the character fitness. And so she was like, that's a good idea. That seems like it might be something that was there for the piece.
Had you ever written something like that before?
Nah, it was my first time writing something that was that long, you know, for a place like the Times. I had written pieces, not as long as that, and that for places like that. But I have written some op-eds and some first-person essays, and I have written a memoir, so, you know.
Right.
But this was different. I mean, it was different in every conceivable way, you know, from, you know, paying attention to chronological order, to the different kind of pressure that was on every single word, to, you know, fact-checking, and also to, like, you know, it was a real need to make it both intimate and personal, but also, you know, how do you make it explode out into the world, and the kind of research and things I discovered and the people I discovered who I still think about, you know, that was just fascinating, who, you know, people who had been locked up and have become lawyers or been locked up and studied law or have been locked up and not been able to do the things that they wanted to because of, like, biases. And it was actually a fascinating piece to work on. And I still remember the end. I mean, we would, like literally for like an hour on the last sentence, it was something, and it ended up just being a comma, you know, really like fixing the sentence ended up being like, let's add a comma right here. But it was beautiful to me because I like writing in that way, you know, where you just try to get the one thing right.
We're just going back and reading that last line quickly. Here it is. Here's the last line. What man wants to tell his child he's done time in prison? But I had. And in that single breath, I'd given him this, an image of his father as both a convict and an attorney.
I think, is it a colon after I'd given him this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think that's the thing that we that was never... Because at first it was like a comma, and then colon, I think the colon was the one. I think that feels like it was it. Because there's a lot going on in that last, and there's a few commas in there, so there's a little bit going on there.
Yeah. Know? Yeah. It's both grammatically and ideologically complex.
Yeah, that was cool.
What was the aftermath of that piece like for you?
You know, it was fascinating. It's a combination of things. I had went to Yale Law School, and then I had wrote this piece, and I think that it carried with it a different kind of gravitas that was interesting. You know, people have read it and talked to me about having read it, and that was cool. When I found out I won the ASME, somebody called me and was like, you won the ASME? I was like, yeah, I think you got the wrong number.
Really?
I was like, come on, man, don't be playing. One, I didn't know what it was. Two, I was like, how did I win something? I never heard of it before. I was like, stop playing on my phone.
You thought it was a scam? National Magazine Award?
Yeah. So that was cool, though, because it's humbling. Because 2 weeks before it comes out, you think it's never coming out. you know what I mean? Just because, like, even though it's just like it's coming out, things get pushed back and they get pushed forward. And so I'm just sort of like, I don't think this piece is ever coming out, actually, you know. And so the aftermath was, but honestly, I struggled with, you know, when I did the solo show, I was talking to my director, Elise Thorne, who also developed the show with me. And she was like, you want to do a show based on that? And I was like, no, I mean, I've written that. I already said everything I needed to say about that. And I do realize that in some ways I've written that piece. And so the aftermath has, for me personally, been a lot of work figuring out what is the thing that I want to say, having already said that. Because mm-hmm. that does it in some ways, I think, really gracefully. But I do think it doesn't get at some of the other questions that I've been trying to write my way through and around, that I don't have the same kind of answers. And that one's easier. You know, it seems like if you go to prison and you do your time and then you go to Yale Law School, that you should be able to become a lawyer. But it's other questions that I think are more challenging and I think are more complex that I want to figure out how to tackle in my writing that I haven't done so yet or as effectively.
What are those questions?
I mean, really, like, I mean, the Kamala Harris piece, which is a really different piece. And I mean, and it's about my mom, really, and it's about rape, you know, but it's also about friends of mine who are in prison, and my desire for them to be out of prison, who have committed acts of violence and who have, you know, hurt people who families might not want to see them out of prison. And so I think I have something to say and to write about that. I think I have something to say about guns that, you know, that I haven't written yet.
Those different questions. How do you decide what medium you are going to tackle them in? You have written multiple books of poetry. You have written a memoir. You've written these magazine pieces. You've got a one-man show. You did a show at PS1 and turned that into a book. You've got a nonprofit. You've got a podcast. How do you, I mean, first of all, how the fuck do you do that? But second of all, like, how do you choose where you are going to put your energy? How do you match an idea with a medium?
You know, the podcast is probably the easiest one, but it's also probably the most generative one in the long game, because the podcast, I interview, the podcast comes out of Emerson Collective. I interview, and it truly is just a collective. It's just a bunch of cool people that have gotten together and have been supported by Emerson Collective to do different things around climate change, around poverty, around teaching history. But to be truthful, you know, projects move. They move from long-form essay to memoir to poetry, and then they move back around. And then sometimes the project that was a visual art project becomes a poetry book that we actually describe as an art book. You know, we try to move everything around so that we, in some ways, defy the kind of categorization that feels limiting sometimes.
Do you see limits in your work? Do you feel limits in your work?
No, but I mean, you know, one of the questions is, do I feel like I'm limited in my ability to carry out the things that I want to do? And I tend to say no, but every project is daunting. Every personal project, every, let me finish this poem, let me finish this essay. And sometimes it's paralyzing. And whenever you write about other people, it's just like, you feel this responsibility, this duty to get it right by them. So in some ways, I would say, yeah, because of that, because of wanting to get it right by other people. And because, you know, the challenge is always, will any of it get done? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Mostly, I think none of it is ever going to get done, and then it somehow happens.
Is that getting easier? You're getting better at getting things done?
You got to ask me after. I feel like I always think, ask me after this next project is finished. Like, you know, when you do something once, you kind of did it. Like, I did this one solo show, and I did it, you know. If I do another one, then the third one, I'll be like, yo, no, I know how to. If I was like, I want to do a solo show about this, I know how to think about it structurally. I know that there's some ideas I could play around with that I didn't play around with before. So, like, and this is almost how I feel about writing a Times piece. I've written a couple long pieces, you know, and so now I feel like I'm at the point where I probably could do, I got, like, one or two more that I got to do that's just, like, rounding out the, like, the one I want to write now is just, as a poet or as an MC or something, it's like, oh, I get that. But I never thought about it as a long-form journalist. But the piece I want to write now is just like a day in a life piece. Mm-hmm. And it's like, how do you write 6,000 words about 90 minutes? But that's the goal now.
Whose 90 minutes would you want to write about?
Oh, it's about my 90 minutes going to a gun range.
Are you working on that one?
Yeah. So first, it's like I got convicted of a felony with a gun. So I lost my gun right. So it's a 90-minute piece, but it's not really a 90-minute piece, because the first thing you got to do is like, well, how do you get your gun rights back? And so part of the piece is me getting my gun rights back, and I got my gun rights back during the pandemic where I had to appear before a judge. And I had to, like, file a legal document, you know, asking the court to give me my gun rights back. And so I don't really want to – I don't want a gun or need a gun. Actually, it was a question of it is a question of, like, all of these mass shootings. And, you know, how do you think about your relationship to guns and your relationship to that violence? And, again, you know, because it's always these two conversations going on. The person I most like is the person that committed the mass shooting. I mean, we end up in the same prison. But rhetorically, when you think about, like, mass incarceration, those conversations don't happen together. And I get it. Most people that's in prison haven't committed mass shootings. But I'm just saying the category of person that the person in prison is in is the same category of the person that the person that does a mass shooting, which is somebody who has, you know, inflicted some amount of violence on somebody else, right? And what I'm thinking about is what does it mean when you can't when you start to admit that the amount of distance between how people view that person and how people view you is not as much as we profess it to be. And a mass shooting is one thing, but I'm just talking about the person down the street who gun went off and killed some little kid, you know. And so I keep finding ways, I think, to write about it because, I don't know, I think it might say something meaningful about it.
When you say that it might say something meaningful, is that like you know it's there, but you're not quite sure what it is yet?
I know it's uncomfortable. It's so uncomfortable that it got to be there. You know what I mean? Because it's like the progressives might be like, you know, the one thing that everybody agrees on is that convicts shouldn't have guns. So now you out here saying that convicts should have guns, you know. So I know that that's a tension. I know that it's tension there. And then I also know that you might have some people who are pro NRA who like, yo, let's use your story because this is a perfect example of why, you know, we need to have expansive gun rights. And I do think seriously. I mean, people in my community have had their homes burglarized. You know, I do think seriously about what does it mean to just be like, oh, well, because you have a felony conviction, you can't protect your house if somebody breaks into your house. Even if we know that nobody actually ever protects their house. But actually, people do protect their homes. You know what I mean? And so it's a really fraught conversation. It has to be something there. And I think that it's one of those conversations. And I was there, so I do know it plays out, you know, it plays out over the course of 90 minutes. Like, like it radically and wildly plays out. And yet, having said that, I still don't know what I think, you know.
It is fraught, what you're talking about, writing about guns. It's complicated in a way that the Times Magazine piece about becoming a lawyer wasn't in some way. Like, in some ways, that piece is kind of straightforward. And the thing you're talking about with guns feels, I don't know, to me, not straightforward.
Yeah.
Is it different writing about that?
It's actually scarier writing about it. And the reason why it's scary is because people advise me not to write about guns because they know that it's all of these parties that I could offend. And they actually don't know what I'm going to say because I don't know what I'm going to say. But they know if I'm writing about having gone to prison at 16 and then gone to Yale Law School at 33 and graduated from Yale Law School and passed the bar exam, that anybody who's not permitting me to be a lawyer seems to be making a mistake. You know, like that's pretty obvious. Mm-hmm. I mean, the only direct parallel I have is when I wrote about Kamala Harris. I didn't know what to write about Kamala Harris. And then when she became the VP candidate, it became very easy to talk about her as a prosecutor and talk about her work as a prosecutor. But I didn't really want to talk about that. People had talked about that ad nauseum. I wanted to talk about why people who I had met thought that her work as a prosecutor mattered. And then it took me to the thing I hadn't talked about in years, which is, you know, I came home from prison and my mom let me know, she told me that she had been raped and that she had been raped like 3 weeks after I got locked up. I mean, she tells me that the day I come home and we don't talk about it for a decade. And then we talk about it one day. And then we don't talk about it for another 3 years. And I'm trying to write this Kamala Harris piece. And I'm like, you know, maybe what I need to be doing is asking my mom how she dealt with that. Maybe what I need to be doing is acknowledging that, like, I was in prison suffering, but I wasn't the only one suffering. And that I was carrying water for something I did. What about the people who had hurt people that I had loved? What about the people that my homies had hurt? You know, what was the world for them? And so talking to my mom was even harder than writing the first piece because I had to I had to become cognizant of a kind of pain and a kind of frustration that I was able to just not account for because the criminal justice reform space doesn't always force us to publicly account for these things. In our communities, we have to confront it. Amongst each other, we have to confront it. But sometimes publicly, it just doesn't seem like a part of the conversation. And so I wrote that piece about, you know, when it came out, it was like the title was Kamala Harris, My Mother and Me. And I thought it was really badass to like, you know, to write something that I thought was thoughtful and compelling and honest about my challenges with like what happened to my mom, with her being raped, with what I thought about the black man who did it, with my friends who were black men who I thought should be out of prison, with the own things that I've done with my life. I thought it was rich and generative and said something about how fraught the role of a prosecutor is. But I felt like it just didn't get the same level of attention and conversation. And people would see me on the train and give me props for the jail to Yale piece. But for this one, it was like crickets. Hmm. And in fact, the biggest respect, the most respect I got for it is more than a year. I was in a prison and I was like, I'm going to talk about it. And it was tough for me to talk about the piece. And I got emotional. And somebody came up to me afterwards and was like, y'all read that piece when it came out, man. Yeah. And you needed to write it. You know, and he just walked away, right? But it was even clear at that moment that it was a conversation that we needed to have in a prison that wasn't being facilitated.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think it was crickets?
Because we don't have a conversation enough to really know how to have it publicly. You know, not because we don't want to have it. And after a while, we got into it, but it was still like, you know, we were working our way into a really difficult set of questions.
Hearing you talk about it that way, you've got a podcast, and the name of the show is Almost There. I was really struck by the name of the show, Almost There. You're talking to all these incredible people doing incredible things. What does that phrase mean to you? Like, where are you trying to get? Is there a destination for you? Is there an endpoint in this work?
Yeah. Yeah, so I think Almost There, it's a nod to this shared struggle that we're all sort of engaged in. But I think it's also a nod to the importance of the journey. For me, you know, you can't always name the destination, but you could commit to being on a journey. And sometimes you're just lucky that you don't have people that ask you questions that would discourage you. And so when I said I was going to be a writer, nobody was around to say, are you going to be a poet? Are you going to be a novelist? I remember subscribing to Creative Nonfiction, mm-hmm. the little magazine. You know what I mean? It was one of the first things that I subscribed to. And I used to read it. And it was beyond me. Because, again, I wasn't reading New Yorker. I was reading Creative Nonfiction. I had no idea what the New Yorker was. So if you were like, are you going to write for the New Yorker? I don't know what you're talking about. So I do have this belief Almost There. It's like even then when I was taking this writing course, when I was reading these books, I was almost there. I was on a journey. I couldn't name the actual destination, but I was almost there. And I think when people listen to the podcast and they get exposed to some of these stories, I mean, some of these stories are so like, you know, I can't even spoil them, but they're so good, man. You ever hear somebody tell you a story and you'd be like, man, this is when you know you've heard a good story, that you both want the story and you know that you don't want like what came with the story. And it's not even just like suffering. It's just like sometimes you could just be like, I'm not sure if I want that awareness of the world that you have from having to live that story. Mm-hmm. Like you almost like, I'm a pass on that one.
Yeah. It's like when you have like a book next to your bed for weeks and weeks that you know is going to like knock you around.
Yeah. And so you just hesitate on picking it up, but then you pick it up and you know, you're happy you did it.
That was a beautiful answer to the question, but I'm not sure you totally answered it.
That's the game of the game. Yeah, but I don't know.
What does it mean for you? Like, is there somewhere you are trying to get?
Nah, honestly, like even at 16, I mean, you talking about you just want to get to your release date. So I get sentenced like May 12th, 1997. I come home on March 4th, 2005. My release date was probably later in the year 2005 at the time. I can't even understand those numbers, 1997 to 2005. That's basically half the years I've been on the earth. I can't compute it. And so Almost There, like every next day was almost there. And in terms of understanding the math of prison, I think I had to constantly be almost there. Even when I couldn't define what almost there was, whether that was as a writer, whether that was, you know, as somebody who was just figuring out how not to be afraid, whether that was somebody who was trying to get closer to home. And in fact, you know, even being out of prison, my whole life has been almost there. And it's mostly been because of prison that I haven't been able to lay claim to. It's a catch-22. It's both because of prison that I haven't been able to lay claim to some of the kind of successes that my literary success or that my the degrees I've earned you would think would afford me. But the reality also is that a lot of those things come from my time in prison. And so, you know, it's like burning a rope at both ends. And maybe that's what being almost there is for me. It's this world where I'm perpetually burning a rope at both ends.
I think part of why I asked was that quote I read you at the beginning about how you're saying you've spent the rest of your life trying to find more and more creative ways to leave prison. I think that's what I was maybe asking about without even realizing it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, when you connect those two things, because it is a destination, which is freedom. But actually, freedom as a destination is, I think, quintessentially the place where you're constantly almost there.
Dwayne, thank you so much for doing this. It was a real pleasure to talk to you.
No, it was a pleasure to be here. Can't wait till next time.
Thanks for listening to Longform. I'm Max Linsky. My co-hosts are Aaron Lammer and Evan Ratliff. Seth Kelly edited this episode. Thanks to him. Thanks to Susan Peterson, who handled the show notes. Thanks to everyone at Vox, with whom we make the show. And thanks so much to Dwayne Betts. His organization is Freedom Reads. His podcast is Almost There. We'll see you next week.
Support for this show comes from Art, Beats, and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Cult Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art, Beats, and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual paths while also revealing their distinct roles within Art, Beats, and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu.
Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Why do you run? Why does anyone?
I always thought that runners loved running, and that's not the case. Most runners hate running, but they choose to do it.
In the new docuseries, Running Sucks, brought to you by Team Milk, Abby Ayers learns why women runners everywhere are driven to go the distance.
It really is about taking my power back and proving myself wrong.
Team Milk is about fueling women's performance and helping them along their marathon journeys. You can sign up now for the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon taking place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16th, 2024. Learn more and register at everywomansmarathon.com.